Stay tuned now for Edward R. Murrow with the News, presented by Hams. H-A-M-M-S. Hams. Yes, Hams, America's most refreshing beer, brings you America's favorite newscaster, Edward R. Murrow.
This is the news. General Ridgway says we've won a decisive local victory on the Central Front in Korea. Our troops took the best the enemy had, stopped him, and sent him into retreat. We have not been able to make patrol contact with the withdrawing Reds for the past 36 hours. The only contact of any proportion in Korea tonight is in the Chaechon area, 20 miles southeast of Wanju. And here we've gained more than 4 miles. General Ridgway told reporters today his objective remains to destroy the enemy and preserve our forces. He hasn't given the matter of crossing the 38th parallel a thought. As far as he's concerned, it has no significance. Another general was at the front today, Mark Clark, the head of the Army Field Forces. He later told reporters, United Nations troops have nothing to worry about. Our men are better trained, have better morale, are better fighters than the enemy. The general also said that a plan is now in the mill to permit veterans in Korea to return home to train new troops. The Pentagon says this cannot be started for some time to come. The Army Chief of Staff, General Collins, told senators today that we've learned some lessons from Korea. We've learned that air and sea power alone are not enough to stop enemy troops. We've learned that it's hard to build up a ground force after an enemy attacks. We've learned that with good equipment, with natural barriers, we can reduce the offensive power of troops that outnumber us. The general made these points in urging the sending of 4 more American divisions to Europe now. He said the people of Western Europe, with our assistance, can build a sufficient force to stop a Russian attack. In response to questions from Republican Senator Wherry, who wants congressional approval before any troops are sent abroad, General Collins said air power alone could not decide a war with Russia. We also are. The West Europeans have something on the order. The Russians have 175 to 200 smaller divisions under arms. In the event of war, we could pulverize Russia with atomic bombs, but that would take time. We need troops over there to prevent any swift Soviet conquest of Europe. Admiral Sherman of the Navy and General Vandenberg of the Air Force both testified that ground forces are necessary in Europe, which makes this the unanimous opinion of our top military commanders. The State Department tonight says that the Russians now have 35 fully armored or mechanized divisions in East Germany and Poland. Further, the State Department says its reliable reports indicate that the Soviets have now rebuilt the East German railroad lines, which they tore up after Germany's surrender at the end of the last war. These rails, says the department, could be used as a supply line from the Soviet Union in the event of an attack on the West. The department also makes it clear that it has little hope of any successful negotiations with Moscow on Germany, despite the fact that only today we joined with London and Paris in recommending a March 15th meeting in Paris of the Big Four deputy ministers. They would decide an agenda for a future foreign ministers meeting. The House Armed Services Committee today informally agreed to draft young men who are 18 and a half years old and require at least 6 months of training before they could be sent into combat. A Senate committee has approved the drafting of 18-year-olds. The Air Force today reacted quickly to a Senate committee charge that it is hoarding young men, greedily grabbing off the cream of the crop. The Air Force has canceled the recall of 18,000 volunteer reserves, men not attached to any organized working units. This is said to be due to the great number of new enlistments and re-enlistments. The president had a visit today from representatives of most of the nation's labor unions, men who had been complaining over the weekend because of what they called big business management of the mobilization program. The labor leaders came out of the White House saying they didn't know whether or not they had made any progress with the president. Later, the White House news secretary said the president will try to handle the mobilization program in a way fair to everyone, without special privileges for any one group. Defense mobilizer Wilson said today that if the cost of living goes up, wages will go up, and only the naive would think otherwise. The government has lifted its ban on the use of copper for water systems in homes. and it has banned the use of copper after April 1st for such products as coffee makers, home and farm freezers, waffle irons, and refrigeration and air conditioning equipment. The president today changed his mind about the future of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Last week, he sent the Senate the names of the present five commissioners for reappointment. Today, he sent Congress a request to put the RFC under a single commissioner, as demanded by many of the RFC's congressional critics. Also in Washington, the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen entered a surprise plea of guilty to contempt charges growing out of the six strikes of last December and earlier this month. The union was fined $75,000. In New Jersey, a county grand jury investigating the Pennsylvania Railroad wreck of February 6th today indicted the Pennsylvania on 84 manslaughter counts, one for each of the lives lost in the accident at Woodbridge. In Paris, André Gide, the 80-year-old novelist and Nobel Prize winner, died today. He had been ill of pneumonia. The New York City basketball scandal is still active. District Attorney Hogan said today that recordings of wiretapped telephone conversations finally brought about the confessions of three City College of New York stars. One of them, Ed Warner, today gave police $3,050 he had received in bribes and kept in a dusty shoebox in his home. Another, Al Roth, told reporters he got involved because he wanted to be grown up, was tired of taking money for clothing and the like from his father, wanted to be able to do things for himself. Warner, Roth, and Ed Roman of CCNY, and Connie Schaff of New York University were all suspended from their schools today. And the alleged money man in the whole fix, Salvatore Salazzo, has been denied bail, is still in jail. A long weekend of speculation about Stalin's interview in Pravda has produced much speculation and a wide variety of interpretations. There has been a certain tendency to brush it off as just another set piece of Russian propaganda. Some observers have drawn some comfort from his statement that war is not inevitable at this time. This may have been designed to reassure Russian opinion. But how remarkable it would have been for him to give any other answer to that question. Could anyone seriously expect him to say that war is inevitable? His whole utterance was designed to convince his readers that if war comes, we will be responsible, together with our allies. Another theory has emerged, that he was leading from weakness, is worried about disaffection in the communist parties of Western Europe, was making a sort of backhanded bid for some agreed solution between communism and the West. Stalin's weakness is not apparent to this observer, certainly not in the military field, and the figures released today and over the weekend regarding Soviet and satellite military strength do not add up to weakness when set beside our present military strength. Anyone who attempts to analyze a statement by Stalin must do a lot of guessing. But his past actions might give some clue to his future policy. And it is here that Stalin's statement that we will suffer defeat in Korea if we don't agree to communist China's terms assumes ominous proportions. Many of us are inclined to forget that the Russians have suffered substantial reverses in the last few years. They took one in Iran. They were frustrated of their purpose in Greece. The Berlin airlift was a victory for the West. Their eruption into Korea has been met and held by force. But in none of these cases did Stalin, the leader, the supreme symbol, put his power and prestige publicly behind the venture. He remained silent, free to maneuver and trade, free to suggest by implication that the blockade of Berlin, for example, should be called off when it had failed of its purpose. But now, in that statement about our eventual defeat, if we don't appease the Chinese, he has put his personal power and prestige on the line. Stalin has a treaty of mutual assistance with Mao Zedong. We don't know all its terms, but Stalin has underlined it, and in public. If it is true, as most military men believe, that the Chinese cannot throw us out of Korea unaided, if we continue to refuse to reward aggression by agreeing to the Chinese demands, then, says Stalin, we shall be defeated anyway. The implication is clear. For our defeat in Korea could only be brought about by open Russian intervention. This isn't as open as screaming and blatant a threat of war as the ones Hitler used to make. But in this reporter's opinion, the threat is clear. I can read that paragraph no other way. If Malik had said it, if Vyshinsky had screamed it at the United Nations, it might be reasonable to regard it as just another threat which could be withdrawn or softened by Stalin, the supreme ruler. But this time, Stalin said it. It is, of course, possible that he hopes to use this threat in the upcoming negotiations about Germany. But he has openly promised victory, one way or another, to his Chinese ally. And the eastward orientation of Russian policy will make it difficult for him to welch on that promise. Many of us have come to discount communist pronouncements, regard them as merely another salvo in the Cold War, aimed at dividing the Allies, heartening their own people, and reassuring their satellites. But there are times when they mean what they say. The Chinese communists twice warned us, through the Indian ambassador in Peking, that if we crossed the 38th parallel, they would move. Many of our officials thought they were bluffing, but they were not. It may be that Stalin is bluffing, I don't know. But there are things in the record to indicate that he may have spoken with a fatal seriousness. If that is so, nothing that has been said since the end of the war should cause us to look with more urgency to our weapons and our defense. This is Ed Murrow. I'll be back in a moment with the word for today.
Maybe you number among the folks who are getting in plenty of bridge and canasta these long winter evenings. Maybe even a game or two of cribbage. Well, I don't know whether your game is improving, but one thing sure I know. When you set up the card table at your house, you'll boost your standing as a host if you have plenty of Ham's beer on hand for your guests. It's America's most refreshing beer, the perfect refreshment during or after the game. Ham's is the beer that's refreshing as the land it comes from, the brisk and bracing land of the sky blue waters. Ham's is crisp and light, clean cut to the taste, with smoothness aged in. So, for extra refreshment and for a touch of gracious good taste, serve Ham's beer when you entertain. Put Ham's on your shopping list. Look for the beer with the letters H-A-M-M-S on the label. Ham's beer, refreshingly yours, from the land of the sky blue waters. Ham's. And now, Ed, what's the word for today?
These are days when nations are making promises to each other. Owen Feltham said, "Promises may get friends, but it is performance that must nurse and keep them." And it was Roger Bacon who gave us good advice for a perplexing world. If a man begins with certainties, he will end with doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he will end with certainties. Good night and good luck.
Edward R. Murrow and the News is brought to you by Ham's, America's most refreshing beer, brewed by the Ham Brewing Company of St. Paul, Minnesota.